This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Matthew Pegas. Great talking to you, Matt.
Great to be on, Robert, on what is quickly becoming probably the most paused show, the not-so-dubious honor of probably being the most paused show to ever be associated with the dissident right.
That's for sure. And do you think we're going to break the record on tonight's show?
I think we're going to break several sodomy laws on this episode, Robert.
Well, I guess to kind of start things off, just to give a kind of basis of moral leadership on a show that might take some, turns into questionable territory, let's just start off with the concepts of what is natural, what is moral, and then what is within the rules of society, and that also concludes both the social mores and the legal code. So, I mean, obviously there's the legal code, the basic law. There are society's unwritten social mores, and that's something that's becoming more and more chaotic in today's day and age. And then
Yes. There
are these concepts of morality and natural law, and there's religious morality, of course, but I think a lot of people say things that are degenerate are violations of natural law. I'm not even just talking about religion. Conservatives often say that sexual deviancy is a violation of nature. And, yeah, I mean, I think that's utter nonsense, because behavior, I mean, including rape, actually exist in the animal world.
To kind of paraphrase a thing that Jordan Peterson has said sometimes, it's like, I don't think it's that we should ask why people rape, why people do these extremely sexually awful and transgressive things. The better question is, how do we get to the point where that doesn't happen so much? Because I really do believe all this stuff is deeply ingrained in nature, using sex for power, namely.
Yeah, because, and I think liberals have the same problem. Liberals often say that human beings are born good, and that they're taught to be, have these like bigoted or misogynistic outlooks. And they're conditioned to that by the culture. So actually you see the same parallels with both liberals and conservatives. Especially
yeah.
the more SJW elements of the left and the more moralistic elements of the right. This has been a basis for a society that transcends beyond left and the right. But the reality is, I mean, the human nature in its untamed form is basically grotesque.
That would be my belief. I mean, do I know that for a fact? I certainly feel as if I do a lot of the time. I certainly have a very, I don't know, Nietzschean take on that.
From hanging out with me too much?
No. I've had this for years. I mean, this is what makes me interested. What made me interested in your podcast in the first place, regardless of if I agreed with everything on it, is that it was a culturally interesting podcast that was coming from what I do think can be called a more right-wing or conservative view on human nature, which is that it's inherently, I don't even want to say bad, because I would kind of move beyond that kind of moralism, but inherently grotesque, inherently tends towards hierarchy and power dynamics and chaos.
Yeah, and I mean, sex plays a huge part of that, because sex is tied in with status and power, and humans in their more primal force that really unleashes these primal urges in regards to things like sex and violence. And mm-hmm. societies were set up to kind of tame that. These institutions like marriage, religions, government, sort of the institutions.
Yeah, civilization.
Yeah, civilization. Yeah. So you go to look at a lot of these different intellectuals, and I want to kind of contrast the Marquis de Sade and the kind of 60s counterculture outlook, because de Sade was considered to be the founder, the father of libertinism, but he had a very different outlook on human nature than the 60s free love movement, the sexual revolution. So the whole concept of the sexual revolution was that free love was going to bring about world peace and create a more egalitarian society. And the writings of de Sade were very much focused on the themes of power and abusing power, sex as a form of power, sex as hierarchy, extreme violence, extreme grotesque acts. And de Sade was basically the father of libertinism, and he actually influenced... I don't think de Sade influenced so much the American 60s free love movement, but he was very influential on a lot of French left-wing intellectuals in the mid-20th century.
Yeah, absolutely. I assume there was some relation with de Sade and the countercultures of the 60s. If not de Sade, then certainly we had our equivalents. I mean, from later in time, I think of William S. Burroughs, was definitely, he was a part of the Beat Generation, and would have probably been something that a lot of, you know, hippies of the 60s would have been reading, or that would have been in their orbit. And he, too, he's a kind of Sadean figure, where he wrote about these kind of, this kind of libertinism, this kind of sexual freedom, but, I mean, his take on it, it's hard to pinpoint what exactly Burroughs' take on things were, but he had a little more in common, I think, with, you know, the Boyd Rices of the world than the John Lennons. But just to illustrate that, these ideas, while they're very transgressive and amoral, if not immoral, certainly amoral, have gotten tied up with the kind of hippie moralism over the years, and at various times kind of come untangled from that and then retangled, and it's complicated.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you made with the beatnik writers like Burroughs and Ginsberg, because they were a much more elite group, so they had a better understanding of human nature. So Norman Mailer was... he was someone who was also affiliated. He was actually affiliated with both the early 50s beat counterculture, or the 50s to early 60s beat counterculture, and the 60s to 70s left-wing counterculture. But around the time of the Iraq War, he actually said that fascism is actually closer to the pure primal state of human nature, and that we have to strive to be better and more egalitarian. And that's actually a much more honest view than your mainstream leftist view. So, I mean, I actually have respect for Norman Mailer.
I do as well. I haven't read any of his novels, but I'm sure they're good. He always struck me as an intelligent guy. And I agree with that point. I mean, it depends on your definition of fascism. Certainly, whether or not human society is somehow... whether or not fascism is the more organic mode of human society, it's certainly, when it comes about, it's a natural process. I do believe it's, like, a force of nature. I do believe that it's... stemming out of whatever issues or disparities or whatever desperations are existing in society. I think it's a natural extension of that. And I kind of view fascism more as a revolutionary process. In that sense, I do think it's very organic. Whether what the natural state of society is or should be, I think, is a much more open question.
Yeah, so not so much fascism in the literal sense, but just this kind of a violent tribalism, as opposed to this idea of just egalitarianism.
Yeah, and, might make right is the most
exactly.
organic state of the universe. I believe that.
So Roger Devlin had a fascinating point in his essay "Sexual Utopia and Power." He was talking about the '60s free love movement and a lot of these cults from that era. And there was this kind of promise of if you join the cult, you're going to have unlimited sexual access. But he said what ended up happening is basically the cult leaders would screw everyone's girlfriends.
Yeah, we see this happen in power structures throughout history. I mean, that is a fascinating point. I haven't read that particular Devlin piece. It sounds well worth a read. I mean, that's how that you could to maybe be a little bit what's the word I'm looking for here? Reductive. You could definitely say that things like the 60s counterculture gained their popularity, not so much because people were being won over by these, what I think are very bad philosophical arguments, but because of the promise of sex. I mean, that's kind of what we're motivated by. And then, obviously, as time has progressed, the sort of liberal left has become much less of a home for that kind of sexual expression, especially for males, which we can talk about later.
So yeah, sexual energy is something that can either be channeled into creative endeavors, and it's an inspiration for a lot of things, for status and economic status, social status, creative endeavors. But it can also be disruptive. So, I mean, not just violence, which is the obvious example, but it can lead to addictions and behavior that is self-destructive as well. But it can also, as you said, it is a force that has been channeled into political movements. And, I mean, that is a Freudian theme, and a lot of right-wing people dismiss everything Freud says. But I actually don't totally agree with that. I do think, he does have things to say that are insightful. So, I mean, what are your thoughts as sex as just this primal driving force behind creative endeavors, destructive behavior, political movements, and your thought kind of on general and on a Freudian analysis?
Yeah, this is a view that I've kind of developed over time, coming from a variety of different sources. The two that came to my mind, other than Freud, who I am an avid reader of and who I was an avid reader of in college, would be there's this book. I'm a Roman Catholic, or I mean, sometimes I am, sometimes I have a complicated relationship with it. But there's this book called The Holy Longing, by Ronald Ruhlheiser, I think his name is, that I was introduced to in college, and it kind of presented this view of Eros as a fire which ignites everything. You can find even in Plato, which is what the Ruhlheiser was referencing partially, Eros as this source of creativity, this kind of source of all of our motivations end up getting tied in with Eros, is kind of a view that I've come to have. And then on the complete, what would seem to be anyway, the complete opposite end of the spectrum, as, you know, a book by a Catholic priest, is Richard Wollstonecraft's movie Pearls Before Swine, in which you have the character played by Boyd Rice. He's an author, and he wrote this book called Pure, and there's a little sections of the movie where he's reading excerpts, and one of them is kind of explaining how, I wish I had the quote right in front of me, but explaining how the sex drive and the erotic drive, and looked at it in a much darker way in that context than in the Ruhlheiser Catholic book, but nevertheless, the same basic view that, you know, that sex and the erotic drive is kind of the basic drive of life. And in that case, it was tying in with fascism and kind of BDSM idea. But I just say that to illustrate, from a variety of very different sources, I would consider those three very disparate sources, some, you know, theological readings I've done, you know, certain sort of proto-alt-right movies, and Freud, Mr. Culture of Critique himself, as they would say, all three, I have kind of developed this view that sets Eros at the heart, and that erotic drive is being both the source, this is important, both the source of all creativity and the source of all destruction. And the idea would be that when channeled in, I don't know, certain sophisticated kinds of ways, Eros goes into creativity, whether you're a literal artist writing a book or painting a painting, or, you know, for example, in marriage and in family, you know, you're putting your Eros into raising a family. But if it does not find these good and what I would call proper, or at least, you know, to avoid moralism, orderly endeavors and creative endeavors, it's going to go into chaotic and destructive endeavors. And we talk about this with the incel issue, for instance. I always say, you know, if you're not, because obviously sex itself is probably the most basic way to alleviate erotic energy in a way that's creative, whether or not you're actually producing children. It's you know, you're forming a bond with someone, ideally. But when people can't do that, especially men of a certain age, that doesn't come out in a healthy way. And of course, I always would encourage incels to try things like painting and stuff, because that can help. But if you can't find those ways, then I see, not that I'm justifying it, not that I'm saying it's good, but I see, you know, the Elliot Rodgers of the world, the Alex Manassians, the general, or even in politics, when we see things like, you know, the alt-right and things, these things are inevitable, this kind of rage, the violence of Charlottesville, the violence of incel killers, all this is a process of this erotic energy not finding its proper outlet.
Yeah, that's definitely true, for sure, for incels. So the whole incel phenomenon leads both to a lot of creativity, and I mean, it does channel energy to put a dissonant politics. I mean, I think a lot of revolutions and radical movements throughout history are kind of inspired or fueled by that erotic
bisexual frustration,
rage. Yeah,
of young
exactly,
men.
Yeah, exactly.
Chuck Palahniuk's new book, which has gotten some attention on the dissident right because it references the ideas quite explicitly, it's called Adjustment Day, it is on this theme. It refers to the millennial generation of men as a kind of it's a baby boom generation, and there's too many men for them all to be like sexually satisfied is the idea. And I mean, I'm not just going to sit here and summarize the novel or anything like that, but it basically goes into how these kinds of demographic situations are hotbeds of revolutions of various kinds, including fascistic kinds.
Oh yeah, I haven't read the book, but I've read a lot of reviews about it. Wasn't there some controversy that he was alleged to have read the Daily Stormer?
He admitted openly to,
oh, yeah,
the Daily Stormer, and to finding Andrew Anglin hilarious was his specific line.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. So yeah, it's interesting if he was just doing it for research or if he identifies with that. I don't think that Palahniuk is necessarily a racialist or a white identitarian. I do think he is more someone who is generally, but just someone who's just very anti-establishment and sympathetic to alienated young men. But I don't think he's...
Yeah, very sympathetic to alienated young men for a variety of reasons. But yeah. No, the book is great. There's so many interesting themes that tied quite directly into stuff you'd read about on a website like Countercurrents. But it's also a very balanced look, too. A lot of the characters in it are actually black. He writes from that perspective. So it definitely does not come across as racist. It more comes across as taking the kind of ideas of, you know, people of their own kind sticking together is the better way that you see on the alt-right, and actually presents it from a multiracial point of view, which is interesting. One more thing I'll plug, because you've had James O'Mara on the show, and this is already, James O'Mara's already written on this, so it's not like I'm breaking any news here, but I would say it's also very clear that Palahniuk has read James O'Mara's work, including The Homo and the Negro, because some of the, there's kind of a homo nationalist utopia in Adjustment Day in the novel, and a lot of the, there's little facts and details that, to me, point directly to O'Mara's work, so it's interesting.
Oh yeah, I was going to say the same point about homosexuals. So, I mean, homosexuals are not I don't think there's that as many homosexual incels. I mean, homosexuals have a vastly higher number of sex partners than heterosexual men, but there are some similarities. So homosexuals are overrepresented in a lot of contributions to culture and innovation, especially creative endeavors. So a lot of the greatest artists, filmmakers, musicians have been homosexuals. But also homosexuals are disproportionately to engage in disruptive behavior. So there are some parallels there.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I've written an article on this, the idea of homo nationalism, on my website, Alt of Center. There is this parallels between what was it, incels and gays?
Yeah, in a sense.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Well,
not so much the sexual frustration per se, but the idea that sexual energy is either channeled into creative endeavors or into behavior that can often be disruptive. So I do see those parallels.
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating parallel. That to talk about this, obviously, you're going to piss off everyone, right? I mean, there is something that most people would say is inherently homophobic about this. But I mean, I think it can be said that certainly in a conservative setting, that the kind of eros of the homosexual is quite different from the eros of the heterosexual, whereas one is ultimately generally, or at least can be, and it isn't always, a lot of heterosexuals, or even most these days, are sodomites as well, but, you know, channeled toward, you know, child rearing and family. The homosexual is by default already in this state of kind of abstracting it. And you do see that. I mean, they're actually tend more towards BDSM type behaviors in sex, but also they are there's like a bell curve-esque thing where they're way overrepresented in people who can obviously channel some of that kind of extraneous or chaotic or frenetic, I don't know how you want to put it, sexuality into creative endeavors. They're not the people that are tied down to this kind of earthly thing of family and children, and instead are more oriented towards this aesthetic realm, which I think is intimately tied with an excess of erotic energy. And yes, we do see that in incels. And I mean, I don't know, I always like to think from the beginning, because I got into this whole scene in your show in a kind of strange route that involved queer identity in certain ways, as well as obviously very conservative ideas. And I've always found some of the, even though MGTOW is like pretty homophobic, I've always thought it's funny, like the parallels between homosexuality and MGTOW and incels and things. I think there's so many, and they're so fascinating, and they're so likely to piss off everyone, which makes them all the more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to my original point. So if you're not connected, I mean, this applies to both homosexuals and incels. If you're not connected strongly to a cohesive community, if you're disconnected socially, you're not bound to these strict social guidelines that society puts forth. So if you free yourselves from society's guidelines, that can lead to great creative endeavors, but that can also lead to disruptive behavior, that both self-harming or disruptive to others.
Yeah, it's just a matter of channeling it properly. And interestingly, just kind of a train of thought here, I mean, the argument in a book like Omera's The Homo and the Negro, and what I would argue myself, is that you know, gays are a natural cultural avant-garde, but also a naturally, they're both a natural cultural avant-garde and a natural cultural elite. But in Western society, for whatever reason, whether it's because of Judeo-Christian values or what, has kind of steered away from, has basically totally steered away from the avant-garde being seen as elite. And instead, the avant-garde has been totally subsumed by the left since the end of the Second World War. But obviously before that, you had, you know, the Italian futurist fascists. And I mean, I think a fundamental theme of this particular podcast, and of, to some extent, like, the dissident right more generally, is kind of trying to reclaim some of that, or it should be anyway, reclaim some of that avant-garde space for a more right-wing view. So that's, yeah, and I think that homosexuals are a big part of that.
Yeah, I mean, as you said earlier, that was a big theme in a 90s apocalypse culture.
Yeah, definitely.
So with this whole theme of power, there's this whole issue of sadomasochism and the concepts of being a dom, a sub, or a switch, and the kind of personality types that get into this. So here are all kinds of theories. So there's stereotypes about people who are submissive, about whether they're submissive people in day-to-day life, or they're people who are usually in charge, and they just want to kind of let go and have someone else take charge of them because they're so used to being in power. And then there's people who feel very weak and or meek and low status in day-to-day life, and they just have this quest and thirst for power and domination. And then there's just some people, it could just be purely sexual. Then there's the switch is a very fascinating idea because my character in my book, Gnome, is a switch. I mean, I don't know, maybe he's more... Oh, it was interesting, he's more of a sub. He gets off sexually from being a sub, but when he's a dom, it's all about, like, asserting power.
Yeah, he's, politically a dom, but sexually a sub, which is really interesting.
So going to disclose whether that it is all autobiographical, but that's interesting about taking these sexual fantasies about sadomasochism and kind of the rule of status and asserting power. So, I mean, I think switches are very fascinating people. And
I agree.
What was it about in the Paul Bingham show about Crowley? He said something in Sipo about switches, I forget.
Well, for one thing, that Crowley was a switch and a very well-documented switch, and that it's kind of it's a rare phenomenon, and it's in some ways seems to be a sort of aristocratic elite phenomenon. I mean, it's a kind of two-spiritedness, which is fascinating. To paraphrase what I understand about, like, Native American tribes would kind of revere bisexual or, like, queer people for being of two spirits, and other cultures have analogies to this, too. Again, going back to...
It's interesting you said that, because both Crowley and my character Gnome in the book are bisexual. So with my character, Gnome, he sees, like, these rich, stuck-up women, and he just has these fantasies that... I mean, they kind of almost border on a femdom. And then him is he just has this rage against the people who humiliated him, and he wants to exact humiliation against them. So everything in Gnome's life is this theme of power and status and the role sex plays. So, I mean, that is the ultimate essence of being a switch if you take it to the extreme.
Exactly. I mean, I am nothing if not a dualist of sorts when it comes to the spiritually and politically. I mean, I just think that there's just these kind of two fundamental spirits of, Jordan Peterson calls them chaos and order. You know, there's the whole yin-yang thing. There does just seem to be this duality to... I hate to speak this broadly and, like, spiritually, but, like, this duality to reality that has to do with, submission and domination. That has to do with power and surrender. That seems just very fundamental to me. And in some ways, I think one of the highest expressions of that can be through sexuality. And that's why I think that there's this natural sense of switches as having some kind of insight.
And it also seems that with femdom, a lot of these femdom bloggers will talk a lot about feminism, but the scene seems like it's an overwhelmingly male scene.
What, doms?
Yeah.
That's definitely what's more kind of socially, like, acceptable is, like, the female submissive, the male dom. But, I mean, I think maybe this is the Susan Block influence in me speaking right now, but I think that there's probably a lot more male submissiveness than we see, because a lot of males feel that they can't admit that. And there's probably a lot more female doms than we can see, because some of that is... being said, of course, I wouldn't be surprised if it leaned pretty heavily towards what we see. Yeah, no, femdom, and specifically related to conolingus-related acts, plays a huge role in Journey to Vapor Island, and it's one of the most interesting aspects, and the way that it contrasts, the way Noam's sexuality with regard to that contrasts with his political views is extremely interesting.
Because the thing is, like, he's all about taking the will to power, like this fascistic element, and the whole femdom fantasies about being about cunnilingus and about femdom. They're just like the polar opposites of that. That's what's really fascinating.
Yeah, but that is what's fascinating. I mean, I think there is something to that idea that, you know, that the people who have a certain kind of power in their day-to-day life may seek out a kind of surrender in the bedroom and vice versa.
But I think that's... vulnerable moments of humiliation, and also they have to do with the kind of... he does put a very particular types of women up on a pedestal, and that makes him feel very submissive when he does that.
Yeah, no, I mean, all this stuff is so... I think everyone's... I might live to regret saying this on a Dissident Right podcast, or one that's associated
Dissident
with that.
Dissident Center, how about that?
Yeah, I guess we're the Dissident Center, so it's okay. But, I mean, I think everyone's a little bit bisexual. I think everyone's a little bit of a switch. I think that you can...
I totally agree. Like, there's the whole... I totally embrace the Kinsey scale. I agree with you, but go ahead.
What was I going to say? Oh, in that, like, primal scene of trauma, again, to go back to Freud, where, you know, that... And I do think our sexualities are often shaped by somewhat traumatic moments, or even, like, sort of red-pilling moments, to put it a different way. You can kind of either identify with whoever has power in that primal scene, or whoever seems more submissive, and you eroticize one or the other. But I think we all kind of eroticize both to some extent, and we may, you know, we're always making up for what we feel we lack. And I think, I mean, it also gets even more complicated, because I think a lot of the times, you know, when you're in a sadomasochistic relationship, if you're a masochist, you're actually the one calling the shots.
That's the key issue, is because there's this concept of emasculation, and if you would read a lot of these red pill types, they would obviously be completely, utterly repulsed by any type of act. I mean, especially femdom, but even most of them are very anti-cunnilingus. But, I mean, my definition actually of being sexually dominant is being able to act out your own desires.
Exactly. And when defined that way, some of the most outlandishly masochistic things, like cuckoldry, for instance, which I'm sure we'll get to on this podcast, but when you're really taking the power and setting a certain humiliating situation up, and you're calling all the shots, I mean, you could look at that as you're in the dominant role. But of course, then again, you're not. You're purposely choosing to surrender to something. So it's... I mean, I think a lot of even people who seem to swing heavily one way or the other, there's always an element of that switchery.
So yeah, I mean, the essence of being a switch is just having this internal power struggle, and sort of also the theme of going back to my book, that he views these higher status women as unattainable. So he both wants to dominate them, but he wants them to dominate him. So it's this sort of element of eroticized rage and wanting power and want this quest for power, but also he sort of gets off from that sense that he looks up to them and just their beauty and their sexual essence, like, kind of lures over him.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's this one way of expressing sexuality, I think, is this drive to almost, like, worship, or this drive to just utterly exonerate someone or something, and that can be a somewhat submissive tendency. And I see that with Gnome in some of his interactions with women. And then just to go back to the primal scene thing I was talking about and eroticized rage, I mean, I think it's possible to eroticize rage. It's possible to eroticize the drive to power and establish yourself. It's also possible to eroticize pain and humiliation, eroticize powerlessness. Both are equally possible to eroticize. And I, again, to bring out the Freudian in me, I mean, I think both are fundamentally attempts to understand, you know, when you've gone through something traumatic, just attempts to kind of make sense of your life and your relation to others, and things that you don't fully understand gain this magical erotic quality, and you just whether through eroticized rage or eroticized pain and humiliation, you try to put yourself back in those places of trauma.
And with the whole theme of this degrading porn or humiliation porn, I mean, it's pretty clear that there's this element of eroticized rage. But, I mean, we had that clip where Luke talks about his history of sex addiction, the excerpt from his one-man play, Eroticized Rage, and his fantasies about seeing all the women that he just says, like, oh, there's, like, he feels that... He's talking about his past, so this was before he went through a 12-step program or Sex Addicts Anonymous, and back then he would see the humiliation these women... For pornography, like symbolizing every single attractive woman who rejected him.
Yeah, it's this sense of gaining power over those who took it from you.
And then he made a really interesting point about interracial porn, because if you speak to most like alt writers, they would just say that it's just be a form of cuckoldry, and Luke made an interesting point. He saw interracial porn, to him, it symbolized an act of humiliation. So he was watching, I mean, he talked about watching interracial porn. No, he talked about that film with Jennifer Connelly where she's a drug addict.
Right,
with this degrading scene with a black, overweight black guy. So, I mean, I do think that a lot of white guys do view that. They view that as a degrading act, so maybe they see that
as an act
of vengeance against the attractive white women who they felt kind of snubbed by. So I think these are very complex themes, and some people might watch like cuckold porn or the interracial cuckold porn purely. I mean, they maybe get off from the humiliation. They themselves feel that they're being humiliated, and that's what gets them off. So there's a lot of different motives.
Yeah, and it's like sometimes we don't even know the truest source of our own eros either. I mean, you might think, oh, this humiliates me, but maybe there is that element of eroticized rage, like you want to see the woman humiliated, or maybe vice versa, you think, oh, I just like seeing the woman humiliated, but there is an element of cuckoldry. Who knows? I mean, these are all just attempts to explain that which is kind of mysterious to us, but I do think that points out a good point about like interracial porn and cuckoldry and things, is that there is that deeply just racist element to it when you're bringing in like black men.
We did a whole show about that with Cole.
Yeah, no, there's that. Well, I'm not so much saying that like people in the porn world are race realists, is that, I mean, if you go on some of the, and I don't do this that often, disclaimer, but if you go on some of these, like, cuckold forums, which are interesting to look at, you know, it's, like, guys who want, like, a black guy to fuck their wife. And, I mean, there's a fundamental, and also to go back to, like, who's really dominant in that situation, there's a fundamental thing where it's, like, these are, like, there is a correlation between these kinds of bizarre sexual behaviors and high IQ, a strong one. So it's, like, these guys just see themselves as cerebral higher beings. Seek out people who they view as like more just like earthier, because they want that as part of their sex fantasy. But like, I mean, they're kind of controlling it from behind the scenes. So obviously there is something that's pretty pathetic about it. I would not participate in this myself, and I don't endorse it. But if you look at it, like who's really in control there, is a pretty complicated story.
So this topic also relates to the whole theme of adolescent trauma and how trauma in youth deeply impacts your sexuality. So this is the topic of ephebophilia.
Yes.
So I do want to give a disclaimer.
Talk about being stuck in childhood, yes.
Yeah, I do want to give a disclaimer. So ephebophilia does not mean that you might find teenage girls attractive. It implies an explicit preference or exclusive attraction. Because there's plenty of guys who are perfectly content, just kind of regular guys are content dating adult women, but they might find a younger teenage girl attractive, and I wouldn't really. I mean, that's not ephebophilia. I mean, because I posted that chart from Robert. I sent you that chart from Robert Lindsay's website.
Yeah,
and about maximal attraction and based on what age men are attracted to which age, and I mean this is not. He's not talking about ephebophiles. He's just talking about some study of average men, but I'm not sure the actual scientific source of this.
Yeah, I'm not either, so I hesitate to really bring it up. But I mean, you did talk to Ogi Ogasi, the sex was he a sex researcher a while back?
Well,
I mean,
he actually
youth
got...
and girls who look like teenagers are pretty much sought out by men all over the world, and also gay men in terms of the boys they look for. So it's not to get into anything about it morally. I mean, it's not. And this may not be a pleasant truth, but it's just not controversial that a lot of men are attracted to teenage girls.
Oh, yeah. He said that basically barely legal porn is the only porn genre that survived the proliferation. So, yeah, I mean, it's not. I mean, obviously, sex with anyone under the age of 18 is illegal and society frowns down upon it. But from a purely biological instinct, I mean, men are just kind of wired to be attracted to women who have the capability to reproduce. So just looking at it from a purely biological standpoint, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's going against nature. And different societies
certainly not, yeah.
Have their own values on what age is appropriate and what age gaps, like what is age acceptable, what age ranges are acceptable, what the age of consent should be. So, there's the issue of biology. And I also want to say, I mean, I think it's really idiotic how society puts it in the same category as outright pedophilia.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's a completely different story. I mean, I think, again, I always hesitate to say anything is necessarily against nature, but, I mean, pedophilia definitely fits that bill a lot better than ephebophilia.
Yeah, because just thinking about it, putting aside morality in the law, it's
completely, you know, there's an explanation there beyond just a kind of sadism why people would be attracted to, you know, 16-year-olds, for example.
So with a lot of ephebophiles, there's this. I mean, this all goes back to adolescent trauma. So, I think with most guys, like your earliest crush, your earliest romantic experience, romantic feelings, whether you had a girlfriend or whether you kind of missed out on that experience, whether you had a crush when you were young and it never went anywhere, and I mean, that's the period in your life when your hormones are the highest and you're constantly getting crushes and you have this intense romantic energy. So I think that leaves a permanent scar on your psyche. And a lot of just like regular guys, they'll go on and get married, but they'll still look back in nostalgia for their first, their earliest girlfriend or their first crush. But with the ephebophiles, there's just something. It just leaves like a permanent psychological scar. And I mean, I've heard it's actually been called kind of the Lolita syndrome because the story. I mean, I haven't read the book, but I saw the film by Jeremy Irons. So, I mean, he actually had a girlfriend when he was young who died. And then he falls in love with a daughter of his wife later on, his stepdaughter, and then the wife dies, and then it becomes a really crazy story, and everything gets all out of control.
Yeah.
That's a great film. But there's this theme of, like, the Lolita syndrome, of reclaiming long-lost love, and something kind of... Because, yeah, I mean, this is a controversial to say, so there's one element of this, of the dynamic. There could be a theme of exploitation and dominance, but I also think there's another element about reclaiming something that's pure, innocent, and unsullied. And I think, I mean, going back to what I said, when you're going through adolescence, because your hormones are the highest, that's when you're having the most intense, like, romantic energy. You're constantly getting crushes. So a lot of men want to relive that, because as your hormones decline, you're not experiencing that much. And some men equate adolescence with these intense kind of romantic experiences. There's just a sense of kind of lost purity. So there's these two contrasting themes within ephebophilia. There is a theme of there is one element that might be more predatory or exploitative. Then there's that whole theme of trying to recapture something that is innocent and pure.
Definitely. Again, it's going back, you know, through sexuality and romantic feelings to try and understand something that when you first experienced it, you didn't fully understand. So a traumatic thing. The more traumatic that a certain experience that you might have had as a teenager was, the stronger, the more you were bewildered, the more you need to go back, and the more there's this magical quality, this drive to go back and understand it, that becomes translated into an erotic fixation.
And I think our society has a very contradictory attitude about that, because on one hand, it does glorify adolescent sexuality, but on the other hand, it's extremely taboo with a severe criminal repercussion. So it doesn't, I mean, the way society addresses this is very schizophrenic.
Yeah, no, society is scared to touch it. We have our own little paranoias and sort of repressed attitudes toward this. I mean, the fact that there's such a backlash against even talking about this is just proof of how many people have these kinds of feelings. The same way, it's kind of folk wisdom, but, you know, the really homophobic guy is actually gay. I mean, I think that kind of logic holds out when we're talking about sexual issues. Their taboo draws from their fixedness in reality.
Yeah, but basically that summarizes society as a whole. Because they're so obsessed. I mean, there's something... They're obsessed. There is this obsession with this topic, and there's that show, To Catch a Predator, which I find to be extremely sleazy and exploitative.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I don't care to.
I mean, if you look at, Michael Jackson... I mean, I think his age range would be even below ephebophilia, maybe. Like,
yeah, I think the accusation anyway would be...
Almost borderline, borderline outright pedophilia. But, whether the allegations against him were true or not, he did put himself in a very kind of a vulnerable situation. But the thing about Michael Jackson is he had a really screwed up childhood. He had an abusive father, and so he felt that he really missed out on a healthy childhood. So there's a whole theme of Neverland, and about...
He has a song where it's like, have you seen my childhood? Just like, I mean, it's all very straightforward. It's all
it's
right
so
there.
It's so straightforward. Yeah. This place, Neverland Ranch, basically the story of Peter Pan, where there, it's basically is literally eternal youth. But what is fascinating about it is there's this concept of the vapor and living in this fantasy world where you're out of touch of reality. But he was someone who had the wealth and material means to actually implement his vapor into like a multi-millionaire million dollar estate. I mean, I've actually it's all off limits to the public, but I've been up to the gate up there in the mountains near Santa Barbara. I mean, it is a really spectacular location. But that's interesting, sure. Is he was able to kind of take the vapor and use his wealth to create it in a physical form.
Yeah, no, which is fascinating, but I guess ultimately dangerous if he, you know, did what he was accused of.
And I have no idea whether he did or not, but his behavior opened him up to a very difficult situation. So basically creating this image of himself, even if, I mean, I think there's a good chance the allegations were false, but he made himself vulnerable to these false allegations.
Yeah, I don't think he could really help himself. I mean, if the allegations were true, I mean, and then some of them might be, I don't even know the specifics of all of them. I mean, this is just a guy who is acting out of some kind of desperation, and I mean, what we call a mental disorder. He's not like a conniving, but he's not like a Harvey Weinstein. Not that Harvey Weinstein was a pedophile, but he's. I could imagine. I have no idea what happened with Michael Jackson, but I mean, I could imagine it where he could have set all of that up with the Neverland and the kids and stuff without any intention of doing anything wrong, and just ended up not able to help himself, or maybe like doing something without. You know, without having, like, planned to, per se. Just because he was driven by a much more id type of drive, I think, rather than Weinstein, who was, you know, was plotting the whole thing.
Yeah, and it's very... I mean, it is a very difficult to kind of come up with... to kind of address these issues in a sane manner.
So, I have some thoughts here, if you want me to fill in. I mean, I think... It's that whole, like, apocalypse culture idea, which I think applies to both sexuality and politics equally, which is that things are best when they're out in the open. I don't know. I mean, I have some complications with that. I know that there's an inappropriate time and place for certain things. I'm not saying we should be, having our six-year-olds writing gay love letters.
No, yeah, that's
sexuality.
Just,
that's just
different. Insane. Yeah.
What I'm saying, but I do think that past a certain age, we should just be completely like what you and I are doing right now, Robert. I mean, just have frank conversations about these things. Politics is, you know, politics as well as sexuality, even things that are totally obscene, like talking about, you know, fascism in a you know, less than, you know, completely dismissive way, or talking, you're just really trying to unpack what exactly things like ephebophilia are. I mean, I think these are vital conversations that we need to be having as a society. And if we really had these conversations, we could move past a lot of polarization, because so many people are just so hung up on their own, you know, principles and moralism that they won't step away from a second and kind of really see what's going on here on a kind of more just a moral level of just, you know, battles of different forces.
And you brought this up in your Homo Nationalist article, but it is fascinating about that kind of a Steve Saylor article about how the kind of decline in communal nudity basically coincided with the sexual revolution and the whole the gay rights movement. So I mean, a lot of conservatives would view nudity as just something degenerate and associate it with kind of left-wing hippie cultures. But you could say a more openness about nudity is a sign of a healthier, more high-trust society.
Yeah, I would say that. Definitely a sign of a more high-trust society. And I don't know, my thoughts aren't crystal clear on this now, but I mean... A lot of liberalism is a kind of enforced, an enforced trust upon a kind of dissipating society, whereas a lot of conservatism is actually trying to preserve that trust. So there's kind of paradoxes there too.
And you were kind of pointing out the irony of like a lot of these avant-garde cultural icons that.
Like Lossie Nielsen and Will McBride, and some of those guys you were talking about.
Yeah, they I mean, there is this irony that they were part of the kind of a left-wing 70s homosexual counterculture, but they're basically portraying a healthy society. I mean, a healthy European society that basically is extremely high trust, that doesn't exist in a society that is socially atomized and dysfunctional.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, there's an irony. There's an irony. That's another aspect of the whole homo nationalism.
But I also think
thing.
People.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people who might be attracted to that work, there are people who would be classified as like sexual deviants. But I actually think, this is my take on it, I think the people who are the so-called deviants, I think they're people who are kind of broken by society. So maybe they're actually craving something that is healthy, and they're kind of fantasizing something in a utopian sense of a healthy idealized society.
Again, and this is another connection between politics and sex, to talk about the whole Freudian way of framed a lot of sexual fetishes as kind of being attempts to go back and gain something or understand something you feel you lost or didn't understand. That's an element of sex. It can also
be
with an element
gay,
of
I mean,
politics.
I was talking yeah. about the whole sort of the heterosexual angle. Maybe like some gay dude who grew up in a... he grew up in some
yeah,
kind of American
atomized society.
Atomized
yeah.
society is nostalgicizing that, like, more healthy European. This homosexual guy is fetishizing this more kind of healthy, high trust European society that would exist in Nielsen's work.
Yeah, I mean, because in that society, there's not that I'm saying that homosexual would or should, you know, living in that society. Not want to have, like, actual sex. I'm not saying that, but there's, you know, in the society we live in, what, if you're growing up gay, what you're kind of bombarded with, and what, actually when you're growing up straight, too, increasingly, what you're bombarded with is, like, the way to express this are these, you know, very crass sexual acts, but in a more traditional society, there's these more, I would say, more creative outlets, like, you know, the group shower or what have you, where this is just a more organic, built-in part of life.
I think, should we talk about, like, ethnic fetishes?
Yeah, let's go for it.
So what's the most, let's see, what are common ones? I think, well, Asian, obviously. I mean,
yeah,
it's so
as
cliche.
Kalader has elaborated on, yeah.
What is he... Does he have a unique take on the whole thing, or is he just sort of giving out the general talking points? Because he does have a... Pilliter does have an interesting point. As you go all over California, like L.A., the Bay Area, and everywhere you go, you see white guys with Asian girlfriends. But if you... it's actually not politically correct to talk about it.
Yeah, it's kind of an elephant in the room in a lot of places. I mean, everyone knows it, but it is... I don't know, people don't... Well, people will even note that it's a thing, like that, yeah, there's a lot of white guys, especially beta white guys, you know, at my school, it was, you know, all the computer science couples were white male, Asian female, so kind of nerdier guys. That's known, and that's a little bit taboo, but people will say it, but what people never talk about is why that is, and Pilliter, as someone coming out of kind of the manosphere a little bit, is willing to talk about some of the reasons for that, and also his other original contribution, beyond just being very open and honest about some of the motivations, is kind of combining it with, I guess, a form of identitarianism.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, there's a segment, you have both the Manosphere guys who are into Asian women, and then you just have tons of hipster, swipple liberal guys who are as well.
Yeah,
and
and nerdier guys and like computer guys
into science, STEM,
basically
work in the tech
thin,
industry.
Generally speaking, thin white guys, maybe with like floppier hair. This is a good chance that they
guys
like
us.
Girls. Yeah, guys like us. Yeah.
Yeah. So obvious. I mean, there is some kind of irony. So. I don't know if Pilliter have said that. I mean, is there a kind of rebellion against, like, feminism or gender roles that have changed in white society?
I do think Pilliter talks about this, yeah. That, and this also relates that to another topic I know you want to talk about, another taboo one, which is sex tourism and the book Platform by Welbeck.
I've read that book.
You've read that book. Yeah, I'm like halfway through. But anyway, there's just more, you know, typically like feminine characteristics or domestic characteristics of a lot of Asian women that a lot of white women don't have so much anymore. This is not my primary area of interest, but I mean, this obviously there's something to that argument. Yeah, but other than the like whole Asian fetish, like I mean, I know you, Robert, have your own version of Pill Eater's Asian Aryanism, your own fetish for a certain kind of blonde.
Yeah, I mean, I'm attracted to blonde women. I mean, but that's not really. I wouldn't say that's a fetish. That's been kind of. I mean, that's almost kind of a.
Yeah.
But you were talking about blondes in general, or a very specific type.
I was talking about a pretty specific type. I mean, as anyone who's read your novel knows, that you like what we might call blondes, blonde Jewish women. But, I mean, I think we can just be forthright about this. You, Robert, are attracted to blonde Jewish women.
Yeah, the origins of that really are based on my growing up in L.A.
This is a textbook case of, you know, having had traumatic adolescent experiences and just somehow being totally stuck in that mindset and continuing to be attracted to the girls you were attracted to at that time, which were women that you perceived as the highest status in your high school, which were...
Actually, there weren't really that many in my high school. But no, I went to a more of a ghetto high school, and my high school crush was actually Estonian. But just kind of the general culture of the west side of L.A. So yeah, those types of women are vastly overrepresented in the kind of elite culture of the west side of L.A. But nobody really, that's not something that's actually been talked about openly, because, I mean, I was having this discussion with David Cole at Century City Mall, and we were filming this, so we have his permission to discuss this, and we were debating different actresses.
Yeah, no, you guys had pretty different takes on the issue with, well, I think something of opposites attract was a theme that emerged, because...
Or he really liked that actress from Married with Children. I forget her name, who plays a girl.
He likes very, like, corn-fed kind of white women, whereas you like women who look pretty white but are, like, a little bit ethnic and stuff.
I don't know. I mean, yeah. I was, like, kind of...
Like Alicia Silverstone.
I think to, like, your average person, she's just kind of a pretty blonde white girl. But Cole was saying, oh, no, no way. She reminds me of all my female relatives back east.
Yeah. So sometimes we don't really like what feels a little too close to home. I mean, maybe that's why, I don't know, I'm largely not super attracted to... And I guess you're the same way. I mean, just, like, kind of average white girls. No.
Well, you know, what's interesting is in the context of Europe, I'm more attracted to European women, but
there's already a degree of foreignness.
Yeah,
there's
a degree of foreignness. Yeah. I mean, even though that's where my ancestry is from, there is this still a sense of differenceness.
Yeah,
I think there is a factor of status. That's definitely true. I also think there's just kind of. It's just kind of the right balance between basically, like, looking European, but then having something that is, basically, like, looking European, but then being just slightly exotic. I think that's...
Yeah,
the
it's, yeah, I get that, yeah.
But it's the thing about it is if, with Asian fetish, I mean, Asians are just such a massive demographic. I mean, with this particular type of blonde woman, they're very, like, they're a minority within a minority, so... I mean, yeah, it's a very, very, very small demographic group.
Yeah, no, it's not a super promising one, unfortunately.
I guess one point I want to make that to kind of summarize this show... So, I did talk about how our society has this kind of a schizophrenic hybrid between its puritanical roots and this... culture of this culture that is, I guess, be described as the kind of massive commercialization of sexuality.
Yeah, so, end of everything.
I do want to make a few key points. So, I think with as far as sexual exploration goes, and I think it's important to. I'm not a hardcore social conservative. Mm-hmm. I think something so, or a hardcore, or I'm not hyper moralistic, but I think your sexuality is something. It's a personal journey. I don't like is how Hollywood wants to kind of impose a certain sexual mores on the masses. And I mean, I haven't lived under social conservatism, but I don't know if I'd be too fond of it. Of that being promoted in a mass either, but I don't like how the mass media is, because I do think higher IQ people, I know this sounds elitist as people with high IQs like above 130, but yeah, I mean if you're high IQ, you have the ability to discover these things on your own. Maybe for just kind of average people, maybe they're better off in a more under a more kind of a stable social. Like social conservatism, so there is, but that gets to there's this kind of dilemma between the stability of more traditional morality of like a strong nuclear family, early marriage, more social conservatism, and then basically this intense basic desire to explore different sexual avenues. I guess what you could say as a degenerate. So, mm-hmm. like, how do you, I guess to summarize the show, how do you reconcile these key forces in a healthy manner, in a productive manner?
Yeah, no, it's an open question, one that my views are continuing to develop on. Then we did this interview with Susan Block, and she had an interesting perspective on it, or on issues related. I mean, I'm continuing to explore different points of view on that. But I think the basic thing that you said, which is that, you know, recognizing that in terms of sexuality, what works for some people does not work for everyone, and what is best reserved for, what I think can be called a kind of elite in terms of some of these more abstract paraphilias and fetishes and things, should not be normalized, should not be taught in schools. Again, I'll say I don't think we should be having six-year-olds writing a gay love letters to each other.
Well, that was in the UK. Luckily, that hasn't spread here yet, but who knows?
Yeah, not quite yet. But, I think it just has to do with respecting what the privacy of what goes on behind closed doors, but also just having... I'm basically much more conservative on what I think we should be incentivizing and kind of promoting to mass society, but also leaving space for individual liberties and especially for people of that are a certain kind of elite, whether intellectually or artistically or both, to delve into these things. So I think it's just a separation of what is incentivized, what is promoted to mass society, and what is fundamentally permitted for individuals. We've come to this strange historical point, or this strange point in the history of the West, or the history of America in particular, even, where the avant-garde has kind of exhausted itself on liberalism and now is going towards more conservative or right-wing ways of looking at things without losing its avant-garde pizzazz.
And that's what we gotta keep doing on this show. So, Matthew Pegas, it's been an excellent show, and thank you so much for being on.
It certainly has. Thank you.